It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
What is with this company's obsession with ninjas?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster, who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
Welcome to episode 677 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, November 8th, 2020. I am the bleary-eyed Solo Monster. Got a few hours sleep after the AEW pay-per-view last night, which was an excellent show. You should all go check out my full review right now. It's up on YouTube. I haven't pulled the audio yet. But we're going to talk a little bit about that here in a second. We got some New Japan news. A lot of WWE stuff coming out of Raw and SmackDown this week. NXT. Big history segment. A lot going on this week. This actually, technically, this is the 13-year anniversary week of this very podcast. So we're celebrating the anniversary all month. But I wanted to just say thank you to everybody who has been sticking with me for as long as they have been. I know we got a lot of people who have been listening since day one. Day one. On SE Scoops. Those are the old days. And the fact that a lot of you are still listening to me here 13 years later is very cool. So I thank you. Audible is still a huge sponsor of this show. And hopefully you will show them some love by using our link. audibletrial.com/solomonster. Get yourself one free audiobook that you can listen to when you're commuting. You can listen to it at the gym. You can just lounge out at home and listen to. And a lot of the wrestling books on there, not all of them, but a lot of them have the author. They have the wrestler actually doing the narration. And there's a lot of books to choose from. So use our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Sign up for the 30-day free trial and get yourself one free book of your choosing. Also, if you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. $30 or more if you want to plug a podcast or a show of that sort. Night Stalker Naif Al-Safar, that's a name that you may have heard on the YouTube streams. Naif follows me wherever I go. Whatever I do, any kind of work I do, streaming, podcasting, he has been a big supporter of the show. He's on roll call every week and dropping super chats. So Night Stalker, thank you very much. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. John Loose Cannon Lopez. Florida Freebird, Brian Becerra. Out of Control, Cody Thomas. Yvonne Bruiser Balak. Believe Yvonne may have been the very first person who I ever gave a PayPal nickname to. So I know he goes back a ways. Raymond the Mountie Medina. Killshot, Keith Hart. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert. Josh the Shooter Stockton, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. God, my arm is killing me. I had my checkup, you know, for the blood counts and everything. And I love it because they take blood and I get up to go leave and they realize, he ordered more tests. You got to sit back down. They go right back into the same vein. I think you move over a little bit at least. Don't puncture the same place. So now my friggin' arm is all sore. Got to get it right the first time before you start sticking people with needles. Anyway, yes, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine. Good to hear from him as always. New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Jamar Ninetail Demon Fox Richardson, Dark Sky Dixon Krasinski, the Wichita Lineman Clayton Nettleton, Ready to Rumble, Reza Shirazian. Thank you very much for the support. Just talking to him a few days ago. Very much appreciate that. Also, I got to say thank you to Rick Taz for the love on iTunes, as well as Jeff Anders. Jeff has been listening since episode one. He says his favorite day of the week is Sunday because of two things, football and the sound off. And guess what? Football ain't year round. So when football season is over, you'll still have this show. So thank you, Jeff. Stephen Handyman Halistick, his good friend Jason Cook, has a Kickstarter for a comic book that he created called Blake Undying, with the tagline, "Suicide is the worst way to find out that you are a superhero." It is a dark humor comic with some sensitive subject matter. If you visit BlakeUndying.com, you can download issue number 1 for free. I did that yesterday. You just click the download link and it'll bring up the entire comic book. And you can look at it on your screen. You can print it out, whatever you want to do. But you can check it out right now for free. See if you like it. See if you want to support the project. You can search Blake Undying on Kickstarter if you would like to, if you want to find the campaign. I know they met their initial goal, but the Kickstarter is going to help cover some of the costs incurred, the cost for color on future issues. So give it a look. If you're a comic book fan, I think you might enjoy it. And the Sound Off Group Messiah, Jeff Lippman. There's a name I'm sure many of you are familiar with. Jeff and Shaw host a podcast together called The Garden of Doom. It's a variety magazine. It explores the unexplained, the abnormal, science, pop culture, current events. If you like myths, if you like comics, there you go, comics again. If you like sci-fi, you'll want to take up some gardening on The Garden of Doom podcast. Just check it out on Apple Podcasts, Spreaker, and all major podcast platforms. So this week is going to be a bit of a busy week, because we're going to have the usual post-AEW Dynamite stream on Wednesday night, and I hope you'll join me for that live on YouTube. We have a little party every week. But then the very next night, so back-to-back nights, on Thursday, this Thursday, November 12, again, the time is not confirmed yet. It's going to either be 8 p.m. or 9 p.m. I don't know if people have a preference, but it's going to be one or the other. I will be live again on YouTube for the Sound Off Inbox 13-year anniversary edition. So I'm going to be taking questions that people have emailed. I have to go through them in the next few days. Won't be able to take them all, but it's good if you send those questions in, because whatever I don't use this week, my hope is that this will be the first of what will be many inboxes that I will begin doing again. This will be the first live one that I do. I'm just going to pull a bunch of questions. If you remember the early ones I did late last year, there's a graphic up on the screen where I put the question and the person, person's name who sent the question in. And then I just answer your questions. And what we'll do, since we're going to be live, I'll take Super Chat questions. We'll have a nice little celebration of 13 years of the Sound Off. So that's this Thursday, November 12th. Get those questions in. Best to email me, thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. You could tweet me as well, @solemnmonster, but email is probably the best way. And just include your name and where you are from, as is always the case. And so we'll have a good old time. That's coming up on Thursday. And I figure Thursday night is a nice, safe night, right? There's no big wrestling shows on Thursday. I don't know if there might be an NFL game, but there really isn't a whole lot going on Thursday this week. So hopefully we'll be able to get a lot of people in there. Last night was AEW Full Gear. One of the four quarterly pay-per-views annually that AEW does. And it was quite the rebound from All Out. All Out was not a terrible show, but I thought was the weakest of all the big AEW shows this year. This one was probably the best of all the AEW shows this year, and one of the best pay-per-views, just in general, of 2020. I thought it was an excellent show, top to bottom. Jon Moxley and Eddie Kingston had a fairly brutal main event. Not as much bloodshed as you might have thought, but there was blood. There were thumbtacks, and there was some barbed wire. There was rubbing alcohol being poured on the thumbtack wounds on Jon Moxley's back. So there was a fair amount of brutality in this match, with the outcome that everybody would have predicted, which was a Jon Moxley win. So he gets a second win over Eddie Kingston. We had Kenny Omega and Hangman Page actually open the show last night with an excellent opener. Probably the best opener on any AEW show ever. That was the finals of the World Title Eliminator Tournament. And Kenny Omega picks up the win. No funny business, no cheating, no questions about anything. It was on the up and up. Just a straight, clean win. Hard-fought match for Omega. And he will get the next shot, or at least he will be getting a shot. I shouldn't say he'll get the next one. because we don't know when it's going to come. And I think the most appropriate likely place for it would be the Revolution pay-per-view, which doesn't come until February 27th, as we found out last night. So that's a long time. I mean, we're still in the early part of November. I would think that Jon Moxley is going to defend his championship before then. So look, I mean, maybe the match happens before Revolution, or Moxley can defend against someone like Brian Cage, who I believe is listed at number one in the rankings. And Omega can just sort of sit on his shot until early next year. But that is the match they are building towards now. It is a rematch from the main event of last year's Full Gear, where Kenny Omega lost in that non-sanctioned death match, lights out match, to Jon Moxley. I think when they finally meet, Omega gets his win back. I think Omega is going to be the one to take the title from Jon Moxley. And then you can begin the story of the climb back up to the top for Hangman Page, who eventually will challenge his former tag team partner for the championship later on in the year next year. So that's how I see that playing out. But that was an excellent match between these two. MJF got a win over Chris Jericho, hooking the tights, heel versus heel, so you knew they were going to try to potentially out-cheat one another, and MJF got the better of it, and so he now is officially a part of the Inner Circle. He and Wardlow have now joined the Inner Circle, and now I think he can begin to try to turn the other members of the Inner Circle against Jericho over a period of time. I think that's what we'll see. I think he's going to try to outsmart Jericho and get him ousted from his own group. Does that lead to a babyface Chris Jericho? Possibly. Possibly, but it's not going to happen right away. You take your time with it. You can get some pretty entertaining television out of it. Young Bucks are now the AEW World Tag Team Champions for the first time in their career. Excellent match with FTR. Started very slow, although that was by design. And I made the comment on the stream last night. I don't want to hear this nonsense anymore that, oh, the Young Bucks, they're all just high spots. They have no ring psychology. You can't watch a match like last night and say that anymore. And I say that because I was fairly bored for the first 8 to 10 minutes of this. It was going a little too slow, a little too much focus on the bad ankle, but that's wrestling psychology 101. Pick a body part that's hurt coming into the match and you work on it. It doesn't always make for the most exciting match, but it built and it built and it built, and I thought that the closing stretch especially was excellent. I think that for their first meeting, after all these years of hype, I thought it lived up to expectation. It is not the only match I expect these two teams to have. And my one real criticism was the same criticism I had coming in, which is the additional stipulation that the Bucks had added of, if we don't win, we will never, ever, ever again challenge for the AEW tag team titles. Now that we've gotten beyond the pay-per-view, I can look back and say what I said a couple of weeks ago, which is that this was a completely unnecessary stipulation. I guess they felt they wanted to add some more drama. It was unnecessary. It was unnecessary. And all it did, I think, for a lot of people was probably spoil the outcome. It just made it very obvious that the Bucks were probably going to win unless they just repeated the exact same angle they did a year ago with Cody when Cody lost, and now Cody can't challenge for the world title. Why would you do the same thing with the Bucks? Why would you put yourself in that position? But that would be my only critique. I thought the match was excellent. Darby Allin is the new TNT champion with a win over Cody. Kind of a shock win. Cody was taking a good part of the match, and it was a series of cradles and reversals back and forth, and Darby got lucky on one of them. And Cody, for all of the little heel tendencies that we've seen from him in recent months, if they are turning him, and I think they still probably are, it didn't come last night. He presented the belt to Darby. He didn't lay a finger on him. Taz came out. Brian Cage and Ricky Starks attacked. So what they've now done is if they want to do it, they've set up a tag team match, maybe on Dynamite in the next couple of weeks, or maybe even this week, with Darby tagging with Cody, if this is what they want to do, against Cage and Ricky Starks. Does Cody turn on Darby? Very possible. Because I don't think Cody is going away as far as this program and working with these guys, because what else is there really for him to do at the moment? I don't know what his next obvious program is, especially if he can't challenge for the world title. I'm not sure what else that would be. And I don't know that he's going to necessarily just kind of walk away after losing and just let Darby have the title without wanting to get another shot. So I thought they had a very good match. And it was the right outcome. Darby Allin, that title was made for someone like Darby Allin. Matt Hardy and Sammy Guevara, hopefully this feud is now over. This was a nice stamp on the end of the story last night. The Elite Deletion match, the cinematic match from the Hardy compound, a lot of shenanigans, a lot of comedy, a bit of long-term storytelling with the cameo from Hurricane Helms. We had a Gangrel cameo in the match. So much happened here. If you want my full thoughts on it, just go back and watch the review from last night. It was exactly as crazy and out there and over the top as you would expect a Hardy compound match to be. But Matt got the win in the end, and Sammy Guevara literally got put in the garbage can and was shipped off somewhere. We don't know where. He was driven off in the back of a pickup truck by Senor Benjamin. So we may not see Sammy for a while. We may not see Sammy on TV this week. And then the two women's title matches, I think I enjoyed the NWA women's title match on the buy-in show more than I did the AEW women's title match. It wasn't a bad match. It was just, again, a lot of focus on the knee of Sheeta, Nyla Rose working over the knee. Sheeta, by the end, looked completely exhausted. That was probably the point, right? She gave it everything she had, collapsed basically on top of Nyla in the end, got the win. I just enjoyed the NWA match. Was a more basic, straightforward wrestling match. Allison Kay was making her debut appearance in AEW. I thought she looked good. I certainly think that she's worthy of a second look. If she is not signed, I think she could be a good addition. If she is a free agent, right? If she's not under contract to the NWA or anyone else at the moment, I think she could make for a good addition to that women's roster. But Serena Deeb retains her title. Sheeta retains her title. That was the right outcome because I think Britt Baker, we haven't seen too much of the doctor on TV in recent weeks. I think Britt Baker now is positioned to be the heel that takes that championship from Sheeta. If Nyla Rose had won the title, I just can't see a program between Baker and Nyla. But Baker and Sheeta, that I can see. So, just a very good night of wrestling. If you missed the show, you want my full thoughts, it is up on YouTube right now. And hey, this Wednesday we get the rematch between Pentagon and Phoenix. Penta and Phoenix, round two. Coming up on Wednesday night live on Dynamite. Meanwhile, New Japan held its Power Struggle show Friday night in Osaka with some big implications for the Tokyo Dome shows coming up at the beginning of January. Jay White beat Kota Ibushi to win the briefcase that will now allow him to receive a double championship match at Wrestle Kingdom. The first time that the G1 Climax winner has ever lost his briefcase that entitles him to an IWGP title match at Wrestle Kingdom and is now in the hands of Jay White. He cheated to win. He had Ibushi in a backslide and he put his feet up on the ropes for leverage. Not a fan of that finish, but it is a nice little twist. You know, Ibushi just won back-to-back G1s. So it's not as if this hurts him in any way. Later on, Naito beat Evil to retain the IWGP title and the IWGP Intercontinental title. That should be the final nail in Evil's coffin for the time being. Jay White came out after he said he was going to challenge Naito on January 5th. So night two, because they're doing back-to-back nights again at the Dome. Night two of Wrestle Kingdom, even though the briefcase says January 4th on it, but he's getting his match on January 5th. He says he's going to take the night off on January 4th. He doesn't care what happens on January 4th. He wants his shot on night two. And then Kota Ibushi came out and chased him away. And we now know Tetsuya Naito was at the Wrestle Kingdom press conference earlier this morning. Hot off the presses here. There's a press conference this morning and Naito spoke. And he said that, yes, he will wrestle Jay White on night two on January 5th. But he wants to wrestle an opponent of his choosing on night one on January 4th. And he wants that opponent to be Kota Ibushi. He says since Ibushi won the G1, he felt that he deserved a championship match. He said Ibushi won the G1 back-to-back year, something he never did. And he told New Japan officials to consider his idea. He even suggested that he might boycott both nights of Wrestle Kingdom if he does not get what he wants. What a prima donna. So now it's set up where Ibushi will get the shot on night one, and then the winner of that will go on to defend against Jay White on night two. Now, I never thought Ibushi would not get his shot at the Dome, but what I figured would happen is that Jay White would end up... I mean, he said he wouldn't wrestle on night one, but whatever. Something would happen that would either force him or would in some way coerce him into accepting a challenge on night one to a rematch for the briefcase against Kota Ibushi. And what would happen is that he would lose his shot back to Ibushi on night one, and then Ibushi would go on night two to win both titles from Naito, and he would leave Wrestle Kingdom as the double champion. Now I'm a little less sure of Ibushi leaving with both belts. I would still like to see it. I would like to see Wrestle Kingdom end with Kota Ibushi as the IWGP champion. But who knows what New Japan may have in mind here. Remember, everybody was convinced that it was Naito's time, right? Remember 2-3 years ago? This is Naito's time. And then it didn't happen. And there are still people who think that, you know, Ghetto waited too long. Sometimes you got to strike when the iron is hot. And if you miss your window, if you wait another 6 months, or you wait another 3 months, or another 12 months, you may not get the same reaction. The magic may not be there anymore. So there are still people, and I don't know that I don't subscribe to the same theory that, you know, they may have waited a little too long to give Naito that big win. I don't want to see them do the same thing with Ibushi. I think that he's the right man. I think he should be the one walking out with both belts. And in order to do that, he's going to have to win on both nights. He's going to have to win back-to-back nights. Kenta retained his briefcase for a shot at the IWGP United States Championship in a real good match over Hiroshi Tanahashi. That sets up a possible match with Kenta and Jon Moxley at Wrestle Kingdom. Remember, Moxley is easy to forget. He is still the United States champion. If he can travel in for the show. My guess is that he would have to fly in a couple of weeks early. And then he may have to quarantine after coming back for 2 weeks. And AEW is going to have to sign off on that because he's their champion. And if that's the case, he may have to miss a couple of Dynamite shows if he's not available. But it does look like that's what they're setting up for. Otherwise, I don't know what the hell Kenta does at Wrestle Kingdom. But it looks like Kenta and Moxley is the direction that they're preparing for. Will Ospreay challenged Okada to a match at Wrestle Kingdom, doing his best NWA Ric Flair impersonation with the suit and the way he was speaking and the way he was acting. He's no Ric Flair. Not on the mic. But he was doing his damnedest. So that match is official. And finally here, Shingo Takagi regained the Never Openweight Championship in my favorite match from the show. Should be no surprise. Against Minoru Suzuki. I don't know what either of these men do at the Dome. Shingo, you know, I'm not sure of there being any obvious next challenger for him unless you run these two back one last time. I certainly wouldn't mind that. All three of their recent matches that I've watched have been very good to fantastic. So you want to run it back one more time? Let's do it. Let's do Shingo and Suzuki one more time. But that is your New Japan update as we get closer and closer to Wrestle Kingdom in January. WWE is now billing the Survivor Series as The Undertaker's final farewell. You can't see me right now, but you could see that if you could see me, you would see that I barely was able to say that with a straight face. The Undertaker's final farewell. How many final farewells have we did we think that we've seen it? This is the first time they're actually billing it, promoting it, as the final farewell, to be perfectly fair. Usually it's the fans who just see that, you know, the end of WrestleMania 33 being the most obvious thing. They didn't come right out and say it, but they sure did want you to think that that would be the last that you were going to see of The Undertaker. And I feel like we've had a few moments like that. Now they're actually promoting it as the final farewell. Survivor Series takes place on November 22nd. That marks 30 years to the day that he made his debut on TV. And it really is the perfect place for him to close out his career once and for all. I know a lot of people will disagree and say that you can't do it there, it's got to be at WrestleMania. Or you can't do it there because, you know, there's no fans in the building. And I will agree with you on that. But still, 30 years to the day, to the very pay-per-view, it just feels right. The thing is, I don't trust this. I don't trust this, and I don't trust them. I am expecting him to be interrupted. He may give a very nice speech, which would be very out of character for The Undertaker. But if this is going to be his final appearance, then this has to be the traditional Undertaker entrance. I don't think this can be the American Badass or just Mark Calloway walk into the ring, because people are going to want to see that one last Undertaker entrance, even though, you know, obviously we're going to see plenty of The Undertaker making cameos on TV in the years to come. There's nothing harmful about him doing his entrance. The Undertaker, for the most part, is basically just an entrance at this point. I'm sorry to say, but that's what he is. And you can keep doing your entrance. So we'll see Undertaker cameo. It's not like we're never going to see him again. But if they are billing this as the final Undertaker appearance, then I don't see how you don't do the traditional dead man Undertaker entrance. You know what I'd like to see? Is him coming out. I mean, he can come out to his current music and all that. I'm not saying go back and just do everything the way it was done in 1990, but I'd love to see him come out with the gray gloves, wearing the old, like, cloak costume. Even, you know, they have to make a new one to kind of mirror the way that he was dressed when he made his debut. Gray glove Undertaker. That's the very first Undertaker we ever got to see on TV. If this really is going to be the last, like, formal appearance for him in the ring at a major event, I would love to see one more appearance by Grey Glove Undertaker. But I don't expect this to be it. I expect him to be interrupted. I expect him maybe even to be attacked. And it will lead to a match at WrestleMania, because Vince McMahon does not want The Undertaker to retire. Even if The Undertaker wants to retire, Vince McMahon does not want The Undertaker to retire. Undertaker admitted as much when he said that Vince McMahon's, when he saw the initial final cut of the last episode from the Last Ride documentary, he wasn't happy with it. Because it was going to be the send-off for The Undertaker, and Vince McMahon was not prepared. Now, maybe Vince McMahon just looked at it and said, look, if we're going to do this, I don't want you to announce it at the end of a documentary. We got Survivor Series coming up, 30 years. Let's wait until then. But you don't think Vince McMahon is not going to try to convince Undertaker? One last program, one last match, you got it in you. Remember when Undertaker finally texted Vince and told him, okay, I'm in for WrestleMania this year? Because Undertaker was on the fence. He didn't know physically if he could do it. And when he realized he could, he texted Vince and he's like, I'm in. Or I know what he texted him, like a video or something of him running the ropes and working out. And I think he said Vince McMahon's response back was just something like, fuck yeah, or something like that. Because Vince McMahon is not ready to let The Undertaker go. He's going to run this guy into the ground until he has to wheel himself down to the ring in a chair of wheels. So excuse me if I don't buy into this nonsense about this being the farewell of The Undertaker. The one thing that is good, with Sting no longer being under contract with WWE, his contract lapsed many months ago. He actually has not been under contract with them, apparently, for a number of months. Maybe 5 or 6 months. But they just pulled all of his remaining merch from WWE shop. It's very similar to Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar's contract ended. They had about a 5 or 6 month period where they could still sell his merchandise on the website, but then once that ended, they immediately pulled all the Brock stuff. And that's what they just did with Sting. So, doesn't look like they have any kind of business relationship anymore with Sting. And hopefully that puts this to bed once and for all, this idea that they're going to do Undertaker against Sting. I think most people kind of understand that that's just not going to happen. There are still some people who are hoping. There are people hoping maybe they could even do it cinematically. But this should put that to bed once and for all. This idea that they've been holding off and waiting and they're going to finally do some kind of Undertaker-Sting match. It ain't happening. It's not happening. I do agree with the people who say that it sucks if this is going to be truly a farewell for him, that it happens in the Thunderdome in front of a bunch of virtual screens. You know, even AEW, they have a certain number of people in the crowd. Last night, they had 1,000 people. That is the most number of fans that AEW has had for a show since March in the building at one time. WWE has not yet gone back to having people in the buildings outside of having a very, very limited crowd at the COVID Coliseum for the NXT shows. But that's it. So Undertaker bidding farewell to everybody, bidding farewell to a bunch of virtual screens and having fake, you know, thank you Taker chants, let's say, piped into the building. It does not feel right. It doesn't. But the circumstances are what they are. And you're never going to have a better chance here. 30 years to the day. Could not have timed it any better. It does suck, though, that they won't have people in the building. The other reason also is not only do I think that there's a very good probability that he gets interrupted by somebody, and that is the first seed planted for a WrestleMania match. Don't forget, they are going to go back to Saudi Arabia. And The Undertaker has appeared on many of the Saudi shows. He's wrestled, I don't even know, I mean, how many, they've probably had, I'm guessing, maybe half a dozen or so Saudi Arabia shows so far. If he hasn't been on every single one of them, I think he's been on the majority of them. So for him, he's getting a big payday out of it. They may well be requesting that he be on the show. They're always looking for those big legends, those legendary names. You know, Vince McMahon calls him up one day and says, look, we have an idea for the next crown jewel, you know, sweet Saudi money show, and we want you to be on the show. We're gonna pay you $1 million. You think Undertaker is gonna go, don't call me anymore and hang up? It's hard to turn that kind of money down. So no, I don't believe this is going to be the end for The Undertaker. But they are building the entire theme of the show around 30 years of the Dead Man and the big farewell. I am looking forward to part two of the Broken Skull Sessions. That same day, Survivor Series Sunday, part two on the WWE Network is dropping of the sit-down that Stone Cold did many months ago with The Undertaker. I mean, they probably sat there filming 4 or 5 hours worth of content. They only showed us about two, and now we're getting the next part. So I'm looking forward to that. I think today the documentary on Paul Bearer drops on the network, so I will probably be checking that out as soon as I am done with this podcast today. In fact, I might check that out. So they have a lot of good content, Undertaker-related content coming to the network. Farewell to The Undertaker? Yeah, I don't think so. This week saw the lowest-rated third hour in Monday Night Raw history, and it surprises me. Now, you might be saying, well, why would it surprise you? I mean, you've seen some of these recent shows and how much of a slog they can be to sit through. Why is that surprising? It surprises me because you would think that these shows would put so many people to sleep that they would just leave the TV on and it would be counted in the rating if you're a Nielsen family. But you would think that you would just doze off on your lazy boy and it would just be counted. Person can't change the channel if they're passed out unconscious. That's the only reason that surprises me. Otherwise, no, I am not surprised. Now, compare that to the final segment, not this week, but the previous week, on SmackDown, on Fox, which was more of the Roman Reigns, Jey Uso stuff. I think it was the Jey Uso, Daniel Bryan match. That did a better number than anything WWE has done in a very long time. Point being, if you put out quality television, if you don't tire people out, because look, Raw does have the disadvantage of having the extra hour. You know, Raw had the right formula when it was 2 hours and every now and then you had a 3 hour show. Remember when 3 hour Raws used to be special? They would bill it as like a special episode of Raw. It's going 3 hours next week. That made sense. You built up a special Raw show, maybe some big matches, but it wasn't a weekly thing. And because of the money that they are getting from USA Network and because the network wanted it, then, you know, they've been doing 3 hours now for 8 years. Almost 8.5. Think about that. We are headed towards a decade of 3 hour Monday Night Raws, and the decline in quality in the show has been steady, and the decline in audience of the show has been steady. It's not easy. It's not easy to do a 3 hour podcast, which I don't even like doing those. But it's not easy to do 3 hours of television, however many, you know, 16, 18 different segments, trying to fit everybody in where you think they should be. It's not easy. I get that. But I believe that when you put out quality television, people will watch. It may take a little while for them to catch on to it, but people will ultimately find your show and they will stick with it and they will watch. The eyeballs are there. They will watch if you give them something they want to see. And it looks like people have that in the Bloodline storyline on SmackDown. On Raw, less so. I thought this was an average show. The Alexa Bliss stuff with The Fiend, best part of Raw for me anyway, best part of Raw right now. And we got more of that on this show. When Alexa came out, she fooled Randy Orton into thinking that The Fiend was coming out. Instead, Drew McIntyre. He swooped in with a claymore. And that led to our first Money in the Bank cash-in tease with The Miz running down. Miz and Morrison ran down to the ring. They called a referee out. And their cash-in got foiled right before the timekeeper could ring the bell because Drew McIntyre ran back down to the ring when he saw Miz was about to cash in. He's like, no. He runs back in, claymore kick to the Miz because Drew wants to be the one to take the championship back from Randy Orton. He doesn't want to take it from the Miz. He wants to take it back from Randy Orton. So no cash-in. Miz and Morrison went on to lose a handicap match later in the night to Drew McIntyre. A match where they had the 2-on-1 advantage, and they lost. Good for Drew, because it keeps him strong, but bad for The Miz and bad for John Morrison, because this now makes the second time this year that they have had their asses handed to them in a handicap match, in a 2-on-1 scenario. First, it was Braun Strowman at Backlash, and now Drew McIntyre on Raw. They switched the briefcase from one comedy act to another. Jeff Hardy beat Elias. Guitar on a pole, bro. They should put this feud in a bag and hang it from a pole somewhere. Anywhere. Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler, they are still the women's tag team champions with a win over Mandy Rose and Dana Brooke. Lacey Evans and Peyton Royce look to be a new team as well, possibly. Possibly look to be a new team on this brand as well. Even though, I say possibly, because on Raw Talk, when the show is over, they were arguing like they hated each other's guts. They were like shooting back and forth on each other, like they just couldn't stand one another. So it's possible their team is not really meant to be a long-term team, and it's more just to set up a program, a feud, between Lacey and Peyton. But for now, it looks like they're being paired off as a team. Now think about this. Think about this. Mandy Rose was partners. I mean, she is friends, and she was partners with Sonya Deville. Right? Then they split, and they ended up feuding with one another. Only for Mandy to then be traded away from SmackDown, and her storyline with Otis was dropped. And then they randomly pair her off in a new team with Dana Brooke. WWE then splits up Otis and Tucker, seemingly just for shock value. There doesn't seem to be any real reason behind it. Then they trade Tucker to Raw, but not before having Tucker turn on Otis, seemingly igniting this new feud between the two of them, between partners. Only Tucker and Otis are now on separate brands in light of the recent draft. Tucker is on Raw and Otis is on SmackDown. So there can be no follow-up. And then we all saw what they did with Tucker on Monday night. More on that in a bit. And now it appears that after splitting the Iconics, and you will not get any tears from me about that because I could not have cared any less about the Iconics, but they sure do have their fans. There seem to be a lot of Iconics fans out there. I will give them that. I do not count myself among them, but there are a lot of people who were very upset when they broke up the Iconics, and even though I may not be a big fan of the act, even I can look at that and go, okay, well, is there a point to having done this? I heard that Vince McMahon apparently was very high on Peyton Royce. You know, we hear these reports come out about Vince McMahon is high on this person. Vince McMahon is high on that person. The only thing that we have proven here is that Vince McMahon, oh, he's high. He is high. I don't know what he's thinking. I don't know what he's high on. He'll be high on a guy one minute, he'll cool off and be low on them the next. So just because he's high on someone one week doesn't mean that he's going to continue to be high on that person two, three, 4 weeks later. We haven't seen a whole lot of Peyton Royce on TV. As high as he supposedly is on this woman, I don't know. It sure doesn't seem like she is being positioned in any kind of meaningful role on this television show. But they split the Iconics up, just to follow up on my point, and they sent Billy Kay to SmackDown just to pair off Peyton Royce with Lacey Evans? What? If you defend the booking of this company, you are part of the problem. Every week I have a few yokels who will say that, oh, I'm the one being negative for no reason. It is not I who is the problem. It is thee. You are the problem. And when you defend this illogical shit, it's like Miro said, I guess, right? I guess Miro had it right. Real fans don't criticize. They simply accept what's given to them. By the way, where was Miro when everyone on social media was decrying the death of Rusev Day and the way the WWE was booking Rusev? I don't recall him going on social media at that time and calling those people critics for sticking up for him. The show is a mess. And this is only one of many reasons why. Break up teams for no reason, put them in some new makeshift team. There's no rhyme or reason for it. AJ Styles is calling himself the captain of Team Raw at Survivor Series. I thought AJ was very entertaining. He brought out two of his partners, Sheamus and Keith Lee. They bickered, Braun Strowman came out, and Commissioner Adam Pearce, or Cap, as I call, I may start to call him Cap. Cap made a triple threat match with Strowman, Sheamus, and Lee, where Braun Strowman won, he would qualify for Team Raw at Survivor Series. And Keith Lee almost broke his neck on a flip dive out over the top rope onto his two opponents. His head and neck struck the ring apron on the way down. Keith Lee is, and maybe this weight is exaggerated, but he is a big guy. They claim him to be 340 pounds. We'll call him 340. Keith Lee is a 340 pound man. A 340 pound man should only be doing dives on the rarest of occasions. You know, when Vader used to climb up to the top rope, and Vader was a lot more than 340, he would do a moonsault. I can't even tell you that was a smart thing, but it was very impressive. But Vader wasn't doing moonsaults in every match. When he did it, it was like, whoa, holy shit, I just saw Big Van Vader hit a moonsault off the top rope. Keith Lee has fallen into the same trap that a lot of these guys have. The big guys, the smaller guys, they do it in every match. They do it every week. It's become part of their routine. It has become routine. Keith Lee is a 340-pound man who should not be diving every week on TV. These people are not going to be content until somebody does break their neck on a dive. I wasn't even watching that particular segment live when it happened, and I checked my Twitter, and I had message after message saying Solomonster was right. Solomonster's not going to like that. I see my rant on dives resonated with some people. Good. I wish it would resonate with the wrestlers. Now, I mean, far be it from me to tell these people how to do their jobs any more than I would want them telling me, or anybody else for that matter, you know, telling me how to do my podcast. But I just don't want to see people getting hurt doing things that are unnecessarily stupid, that don't need to be done. They don't need to be doing these things. Not every week. Leave the diving to a select few. We don't need to see Keith Lee doing dives. Then later in the same show, we had Drew McIntyre diving out of the ring. Same exact move. The same flip dive that Keith Lee did. So if Keith Lee is diving, and then an hour later, Drew McIntyre is doing the same thing, that just, it just proves my point. They just proved my point. If you're having these two guys do the same thing within an hour of each other on the same night, on the same show, then what purpose does it serve? It doesn't even look good. You've got these two goofs on the outside standing there waiting to catch you. I mean, that's pretty much every dive spot. But it's not even like it looks good. If I was wrestling somebody and I had a 300-pound man diving out of the ring at me, you know what I would do? I would step to the side and I would watch them splat on the ground. And then I would laugh and I would take my count out victory. And meanwhile, Strowman won to qualify for the team. So much for the effectiveness of the dive. Braun Strowman won the match. Nia Jax beat Lana and then put her through the announce desk for the seventh straight week after her husband told Vince McMahon to shove his brass ring up his ass. Shelton Benjamin and Cedric Alexander beat the New Day in a non-title match. MVP said that the Hurt Business wanted the tag team titles as their payment for taking out Retribution, which they did not do. Retribution, in fact, was on this show a little bit later on. But he said that he wanted that as payment from the company for taking out Retribution. I would think they could have aimed a little bit higher than the tag team titles. But the win should be enough to earn them a crack at those titles soon. And it was a good match. So I don't really have any complaints about that. But then we get to Tucker. When Tucker cost Otis his Money in the Bank briefcase at Hell in a Cell, I said that's it. I said that's the end for Tucker. It was over for him the moment he got drafted to Monday Night Raw and away from Otis. But when he turned on him, that just sealed the deal. WWE has a tag team problem in that they don't have enough of them. They don't have enough actual tag teams. So I'm not talking about, you know, just the makeshift ones that they put together. They have a tag team problem. Heavy Machinery was one of those actual real teams. And they never did hold the tag team titles. There was no reason to split them up. It never made any sense. It still doesn't make any sense. Otis was the one who always got the attention because he was fun to watch and he's got a certain charisma about him and he acts all goofy and funny on TV. And Vince McMahon is a fan of his. He probably has a nice belly laugh when Otis does something funny on TV. In his promo after he betrayed Otis, what Tucker said was a shoot. Everybody always talked about Otis, and he was the one who was overlooked. And I felt bad enough that, you know, even when I was talking about how much I liked Otis, here's how badly I felt about it. That when you heard me talking about Otis months ago, and I was digging everything he was doing, and the Otis and Mandy stuff to me was one of my favorite parts of WWE television earlier in the year. And then he got the big payoff, right? He got the big kiss from Mandy Rose at WrestleMania. Unfortunately, it came inside of an empty performance center and not in front of a live crowd. But I was digging it. I was digging the whole storyline. And even I, in some of my reviews, would have to stop myself and take a minute or two to give some credit to Tucker. And I would say, hey, give Tucker credit too. Tucker looked really good in this match. Tucker was, you know, he was looking really athletic in some of the stuff he was doing in this match because he was constantly being overlooked. The dude can move. You know, he's got talent. I don't know what his ceiling is, but he's definitely got some talent. Monday night, we got a look into Tucker's future, and it does not look good. He had a match with Ricochet. He got no entrance. He was already standing in the ring when Ricochet made his way down. Like a lot of you, I swear, when they first showed him on TV, I thought that he was an enhancement guy they brought in to do the job. It didn't even look like Tucker. He was barely recognizable. He was just different enough in what he was wearing and him standing there in the corner like that, that I did not even recognize him. He had no shirt. He had no singlet. He had long pants with the name Knight written on the back. He got his last name back. He used to be Tucker Knight. So for one night, he got his name back. And then Ricochet immediately hit the recoil and pinned him in 30 seconds. Goodbye, Tucker. We knew this would happen, but it doesn't even look like we're going to get the match with him and Otis. We never even got that. The Tucker we saw on Monday night was not the Tucker of Heavy Machinery. That was a completely different person. The person that we got on Monday night, what we saw was Tucker Knight, Wrestling Challenge Jobber from 1991. That's what we got. And it didn't have to be that way. And when you see what happened with Otis on Friday night on SmackDown, he lost to Seth Rollins and failed to qualify for the men's team at Survivor Series. He already lost his briefcase. He lost his tag team partner. He's no longer with Mandy Rose on TV. Again, I ask the question, who exactly benefited from splitting these two up? Because it doesn't seem to me that either one of these guys benefited. If you could point to me and say, well, one guy really got over and it sucks for the other guy, but at least this guy now is being elevated, or he's more of a star now than he was before. You can't say that about either one of these guys. So it's the rare booking move where you do a split or you do a turn and then both guys don't get over. Both guys are actually less popular than they were beforehand. That is the state of Otis and Tucker at the moment. So what was the benefit here? I ask you, where is the upside in making the move that they made? Retribution came out. We had Teabag, Mace, Slapdick, and Reckoning. No retaliation. And now we know why. According to a report on Fightful.com, the reason Mercedes Martinez is no longer a part of Retribution, as she was there for a few weeks, is because she asked to be removed from the storyline. Imagine being called up to the main roster for your big break after 20 years in the business for Mercedes Martinez. She has been around for a very long time on the independent scene, and she got her big break signing a contract with WWE. Okay, so she's been around for a while since she made her debut. 20 years in the business. Imagine realizing that you finally get your big break, the big call-up, and it's for Retribution. And then requesting to be sent back to NXT. Smart lady. They beat up Ricochet. Ali gave orders to T-Bag and Mace, who hit a double choke slam. Poor Ricochet. Poor Ricochet, this fucker, he goes from getting his ass kicked on TV every single week by the Hurt Business. And now he's getting his ass kicked by Retribution. So he just traded one faction for another. If we get one good thing out of this, it might be more matches between Ricochet and Mustafa Ali. They had a couple of really good ones on Main Event a few months ago. That's where Tucker will be very soon. For those of you who want to see Tucker, you should start tuning into Main Event when it drops on Hulu. And Drew McIntyre beat The Miz and John Morrison in the Main Event 2-on-1. That is the Main Event that marked the lowest rated third hour, possibly the lowest rated hour period in the history of Monday Night Raw. Randy Orton flew in, hit McIntyre with an RKO as payback for the Claymore that he ate at the beginning of the show. Before the Main Event, I actually like this. Before Drew McIntyre went out for his main event, he was stopped in the hallway backstage by Sheamus. And they're like, best of friends. Hey, what's going on? And we were told later on they've been friends for 15 years, which is true. That is a shoot. They've been very good friends for a very, very long time. Their paths have very rarely, I think, if ever really crossed on TV, certainly not in like a major program. I mean, they worked against each other on the independents. They worked against each other, possibly, I think, in FCW, but never really on the main roster. So they were talking like best friends, and it's something you don't really see very often because Sheamus on TV is positioned as the heel. And Drew McIntyre is one of the top, if not the top, babyface on the Raw brand, if not the entire company right now. And it's something that you don't see very often on WWE television, where you have a face and a heel kind of mixing together backstage as really good friends. And they were talking about trying to form the Celtic Connection. Sheamus was trying to recruit him to come onto Team Raw at Survivor Series. He goes, look, we'd love to have you on the team. We can reform the Celtic Connection. And McIntyre said, look, nothing would make me happier than to fight alongside of you side by side, but I can't. My mind is on Randy Orton, and I'm focused on the WWE Championship. And Sheamus said, all right, fella, I understand, but if you change your mind, let me know. And he wished him well, and off went McIntyre to wrestle his handicap match against Beavis and Butthead. I like the idea of acknowledging the friendship between the two of them. They also, and this is a video I would recommend you go watch. First of all, if you did not see the Ilya Dragunov-Walter UK title match on NXT UK, even if you're not a fan of the NXT UK brand, and I don't watch week to week, but watch that match. That will be, if not the match of the year in WWE, it will be in the conversation top two or three matches all year in the company. Everybody is raving about this match, you know, and maybe it's not for everybody. Maybe there's going to be people who don't like that stiff style. But what they did is they have a video up on the WWE YouTube channel of various people from Shawn Michaels to William Regal to Cesaro in the back with Tyson Kidd. And then Drew McIntyre and Sheamus, it looks like they're in a hotel room or something. They have, they replay the entire UK title match, but they splice in clips of all of these people as they're watching along. So they're also watching or rewatching the match and giving their commentary as the match goes on. And there you see McIntyre and Sheamus. They're actually in the same room together giving their commentary on the UK title match. It's a very good video. And it's a good excuse if you already saw the match once to go back and watch it again. Only this time you get commentary from all the different parties, all the different wrestlers. But yeah, I like acknowledging the friendship on TV. And I thought that was an easy program to do if McIntyre had not lost the championship. That could have maybe been your WWE title match of the Royal Rumble. We are going to get a McIntyre-Sheamus program. I just don't know if it'll be for the championship or not. It should be. But they have time. You don't need to rush into that. Tomorrow night, WWE has announced a second chance qualifier for the final spot on Team Raw at Survivor Series between Jeff Hardy, Matt Riddle, and Elias. All three men lost their respective qualifying matches. One of them will have a second chance to get a spot on Team Raw. I think it'll be Riddle. I kind of feel like Hardy and Elias are just going to end up canceling each other out. They've also announced a moment of bliss with Drew McIntyre, and I believe that is all they have announced so far for tomorrow night, which brings me to SmackDown. We had another strong outing for Sasha Banks and Bayley. They went one-on-one in a rematch from Hell in a Cell for the SmackDown Women's Championship. And finally, Sasha Banks is able to put her past demons to rest. Her first title defense is a successful one. She retains her championship over Bayley. She will face Asuka, non-title, Raw versus SmackDown at Survivor Series. And if I'm booking this out to WrestleMania, like I said, I think it was 2 weeks ago, if I'm booking this out to WrestleMania, Sasha Banks is the one defending that championship against Bianca Belair. Bianca is getting the big push. They have the video packages for her. That is the match to build to. I think Survivor Series is going to be a very big night for Bianca Belair. I think they're going to put her over strong, and she may even wind up being the sole survivor for Team SmackDown in their Survivor Series match. When the match with Sasha and Bayley was over and Bayley tapped out, Sasha was leaving. She's walking up the ramp. Carmella attacks Sasha Banks on the stage. She planted her face first down on the stage with the X Factor. I don't think her new makeover is going to make a difference. It'll make for a good title defense or two for Sasha Banks. But Sasha Banks should not be losing the championship to Carmella. As an interim feud, it's fine. Years ago, Chris Jericho and Kane started a feud over a cup of coffee. Jericho accidentally spilled on Kane backstage. And remember, Jericho makes the joke, "I'm sorry, Kane, I hope I didn't burn you." And then Kane just lost his shit. He started throwing things and flipped the table over because Jericho was making a burn joke. The coffee-fearing Kane. On this show, the main event was born out of a meeting in the back with Jey Uso and Kevin Owens. Jey Uso was fetching coffee. And Kevin Owens comes over, and Owens thought that Paul Heyman should be the one who goes and fetches coffee for Roman Reigns. It shouldn't be Jey Uso. And Jey was very offended by this. And later on, Roman Reigns told Jey Uso, he goes, "Kevin Owens, he disrespected us. He disrespected our bloodline. And you need to go take care of things." And so that set up the main event between two of the members of Team SmackDown at Survivor Series, Kevin Owens and Jey Uso. What it also does is it positions KO as a future contender and challenger for Roman Reigns and the Universal title, because he is going to need babyfaces to mow down. He's going to need babyfaces to beat. They have exhausted the matches between Roman Reigns and Jey Uso. And the only question is, when do you do the match? Do you do Kevin Owens and Roman Reigns at TLC? Because you're going to need a pay-per-view main event at TLC. Do you do it at TLC? You've also got Daniel Bryan. That is a match that needs to happen. And you could save it for WrestleMania. You could. Daniel Bryan and Roman Reigns would be a fine option for the Universal title of WrestleMania. I don't think that that's what's going to happen. I like the idea of having Big E win the Royal Rumble and going on to challenge for the championship of WrestleMania if they're not able to get The Rock in, which I don't think they will. But if they try and they're not able to get The Rock in for a match with Roman, that would be the biggest match you could do with Roman Reigns at WrestleMania. I like Big E as the... I hate calling him the backup option, but that would be the good backup if you can't get Rock in for a match with Roman. In that case, I would do Reigns and Owens at TLC, and then I would save Roman and Bryan as the championship match for the Royal Rumble. That's how I would probably work that out. Rey Mysterio and Baron Corbin, I thought was a bore. Baron Corbin. Rey wrestled the match in a t-shirt and sweatpants because he was too preoccupied before the match to actually put his gear on. He was trying to get a hold of his daughter who wasn't answering her cell phone. So Seth Rollins, in the middle of this match, he comes walking out to observe, and they spent more time cutting to and from shots of Seth Rollins on the stage than I felt like than they did the match itself. Back and forth, they kept cutting to Seth Rollins on the stage. Dominic was at ringside, and when it looked like Rey had victory in hand, Rollins attacked Dominic. Rey saw this, Rey went outside, he attacked Rollins, "Get off my son." And with him being distracted when he got back into the ring, Corbin hit a botched end of days for the win. It looked pretty bad. You would think a guy like Rey, he's a small guy, he could go up easy and really sell that move and make it look good, but they just didn't time it right, so it looked botched. Corbin now qualifies for the men's team at Survivor Series. Ruby Riott, who has a new haircut, beat Natalya and Zelina Vega to qualify for the women's team at Survivor Series. Seth Rollins beat Otis to qualify for the men's team. Beat him in under 5 minutes. He did so with a little bit of help from Murphy. He was on the apron. He distracted Otis, which led to a curb stomp and a win for Seth Rollins, who was shocked by this turn of events. He couldn't believe that Murphy had provided. I mean, Murphy didn't do anything, really. He just stood there, but he provided the distraction. He provided the assist, and Rollins was was very surprised by this. Backstage, Rollins found Murphy, and he wanted to know, does this mean what I think it means? And Murphy pointed at him and said, Messiah? And he pointed back at himself and he said, Disciple. And Rollins was giddy and he ran off, and then here comes Aaliyah, and Aaliyah is pushing Murphy and yelling at Murphy. She started shoving this guy like she found texts on his phone at 3 a.m. from Juventud's daughter. Now you're helping Seth. What are you doing? And he tried to explain to her, look, trust me. So he's Jake Roberts all of a sudden. Trust me. It's all for the greater good. So Murphy is setting up Rollins for a fall, probably at Survivor Series. But I still don't know where the Murphy-Aaliyah stuff is headed. I still am scratching my head. If there's an end game here for these two that is not wedding bells, what is the end game here between these two? I haven't quite figured that part out yet. We had another sit-down interview with Lars Sullivan, this time with Michael Cole. I didn't really have any major issues with the one that he did with Corey Graves the week before. I said they're trying to add layers to his backstory and develop the character a little bit more than just being the brute who comes out and screams and throws people around. And there's nothing wrong with that, but this was just bad. I mean, this just repeated a lot of what he already said the week before. There was a lot of stalling, a lot of heavy breathing. I mean, that's all this really was just heavy breathing. I hope he gets COVID tested. His breathing was very concerning. That's all it was. That was 97% of the segment. And here's the other thing that just annoyed the absolute shit out of me. And this would be a good time to resurrect the old intro for this segment. Eric Bischoff, take it away.
Kevin Dunn, what the hell was that?
We've got to talk about these awful cut-ins that Kevin Dunn insists on doing when they cut back and forth from the Thunderdome to the backstage segment, back into the arena. You know, they're awful. They cut back to the arena and they show a person on a screen with all that piped in fake crowd noise. I mean, since they don't have people in the building anymore, they can't cut to them and show us the back of their heads. So they do this instead. And I am baffled. I'm baffled that people who are supposed to be the best at what they do for a living, for all the praise that people will heap on the WWE production team and some of the production video packages that they put together, they do some tremendous work. And I am baffled that people who are supposed to be the best at what they do on that production team can make such stupid decisions in what they think makes for good TV. Do they really think that that looks good when they do that? There is nobody in the building. Nobody. Outside of the announcers and the camera people. That's it. There's no fans. There's nobody in the building. Just a bunch of screens. What is the purpose of doing this? Stop it. Stop doing that. Jey Uso pinned Kevin Owens. With some help from a theme music distraction, Paul Heyman had waddled down to the ring during the match to observe. And later on, when it looked like Kevin Owens was setting up for the win, Roman Reigns' theme music started blaring, which briefly distracted Owens and briefly distracted the referee. And that's when Jey Uso used his head as a battering. He literally used his head. He used his head as a battering ram right into the balls of Kevin Owens for the low blow. Roman never did come out. His music played, but he never did come out during the match. Jey Uso super kicked him, Samoan splash off the top rope, and he got the pin. Jey Uso now has pinfall victories on TV over AJ Styles, Daniel Bryan, and Kevin Owens. And he has now had two pay-per-view title matches with Roman Reigns. So this association with Roman Reigns has been very good to Jey Uso. He was still somewhat conflicted about the whole situation earlier in the show. But by the end here, he left the ring and he was slapping hands with Paul Heyman. He fell in line with his cousin when Roman Reigns finally did walk out onto the stage. Jey Uso stood next to him. He has fallen in line. I like the Uso stuff with Reigns, as usual. And the Sasha Bailey match was very good. And that really was all that I liked from this show. But, you know, that was the key stuff. So when you like the key stuff from the show, I would give that show a thumbs up. Now we come to NXT. We had two very good women's matches on NXT this week. A surprising Dakota Kai win over Ember Moon. Ember's second match, only her second match since coming back from her injury, and her first loss. I like the new attitude that she's showing. She does some trash talking during her matches. I like that change. Raquel Gonzalez provided a very timely distraction. Ember got crotched on the top rope and then caught with a draping go kick to give the win to Dakota Kai, who should not be forgotten about. You know, I talk a lot about Rhea Ripley and even Raquel Gonzalez in the match they had at Halloween Havoc was very good. I talk about them. I talk about Ember Moon being back. I talk about Toni Storm being back. Io Shirai is the champion. But we should not forget about Dakota Kai. And I think she needed this win. Dexter Lumis, he beat Cameron Grimes at Halloween Havoc in the Haunted House of Horrors match. But it was Cameron Grimes who was on TV this week, not Lumis. Lumis was nowhere to be found. And Grimes is still selling that he is scared. He is not fully recovered from that match at Halloween Havoc. Tap him on the shoulder, he gets all spooked. He especially gets very just terrified when he sees that one referee who was in the zombie makeup. Now he is out of the zombie makeup, but he obviously still sees him as a zombie whenever he sees the referee. And during the match here he had with Kushida, the referee got bumped. And so then the zombie ref ran down to the ring. And when Grimes saw who it was, Kushida already had him. I think he had him in the hoverboard lock. And he was hanging on. And when he looked over and saw who the referee was, he immediately began to just furiously tap out. And then he rolled out of the ring. So they're going to continue to play this up for comedy. I like Grimes in this role that he's, you know, been in on TV. I find it very entertaining. And he's one of the parts I actually look forward to the most when I watch NXT each week. Drake Maverick and Killian Dane were out for a match with Ever Rise. They got the win over Ever Rise by disqualification when Pat McAfee's new crew came walking down to the ring. McAfee was actually the camera operator, so he was operating a camera as they entered the building and they went down to ringside. He was filming the whole thing as Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch ran in to attack Dane and Maverick. Pete Dunne, of course, is with them as well, so just this massive beatdown. Go to commercial, they come back, and they're all in the ring, and Pat McAfee has a microphone in his hand, and he cuts this great promo, and he talks about them being the best four-man group in all of wrestling, and we're, you know, what makes us different from those other guys is we're not all just a bunch of scumbags. We're pros. We're men of class. And McAfee is talking about, tonight, we honor the Undisputed Era. We're going to honor the group that came before us. They're going to hang an Undisputed Era banner up in the arena, he says. And instead of raising the banner to the rafters, they put it in a trash can. And Pete Dunne, he had a lighter, threw the lighter into the garbage can. It briefly went up in a flame. Then it kind of fizzled out and it was just smoking. I don't think the flame lasted as long as... See, this was the opposite of what happened when Hulk Hogan once burned a copy of the Wrestling Observer on a WCW pay-per-view in a segment with Macho Man and Sting. They set that thing on fire. They almost had a raging inferno. You could see the look of concern on the face of the Macho Man when they couldn't put this fire out. Sting had grabbed a bottle of water. He's trying to put the flame. This was the opposite. This was, they wanted, I think, this big flame, and it just very quickly flamed out. But I like, one thing I like that they did here is they had, Pete Dunne didn't have a lot to say, but he did mention Roderick Strong by name, and he mentioned how he had learned from Roderick Strong, and they called back to something that happened years ago on NXT. They called back to something that happened. Was it years ago? Yeah, I think it was. It was 2 years ago. If you remember, Roderick Strong and Pete Dunne were a team in the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic. And they went all the way to the finals of the tournament at TakeOver New Orleans. And in that match, Pete Dunne had the match won for his team, and Roddy turned on him. He turned on his partner, and that's where Roderick Strong ended up becoming a member of the Undisputed Era. And Pete Dunne never forgot about that. And he said last week when he attacked Kyle O'Reilly, all he was doing was returning the favor. So there's a rare bit of long-term storytelling callback from WWE. I'm less shocked that it happened in NXT. It's not the sort of thing, rarely would you see something like that, that sort of storyline continuity on the main roster. It does happen from time to time, not as often. But I like that. I like that they call, and it makes sense too. I had forgotten all about it. I had forgotten the fact that Roddy had turned on Pete Dunne. So when he attacked Kyle last week, I didn't really put two and two together, but it does make sense that he never forgot what Roddy did to him. So McAfee and his group, they go to leave the building, they exit, and they're attacked by Killian Dane. Killian Dane is trying to get back at them, and the numbers are just too great. They overwhelm him. And they slammed a car door on his head. They filmed this in such a way where we couldn't really see it. And then they ended up driving away. McAfee, he's sitting in the driver's seat. He looks dead into the camera and he goes, "We're the greatest. You suck. Cheers." And he drives off. And when they pan back to Killian Dane, he's laying with a pool of blood on the floor, just blood pouring out of his mouth. This is a good angle. I am enjoying the Pat McAfee stuff. Pete Dunne just looks like a totally different person. He really does. I mean, he really has gotten himself into the best shape of his life. This guy looks like a guy who is ready to challenge Finn Balor for the NXT Championship, and I hope we get that match very soon, although we still don't know what the status is of Finn Balor. Toni Storm beat Shotzi Blackheart. Blackheart accused, she came out running to the ring, not on her tank. And she made a beeline for Toni Storm, and she accused Toni Storm of stealing her mini-tank, which, as I mentioned, she did not ride down to the ring like she normally does. Early on in the match, Shotzi slipped on the ropes and fell into the ring, so that was a bad botch. It happens, but I'm sure that was very embarrassing. Shotzi springboarded at one point off the ropes into a tornado DDT on the apron. So Shotzi Blackheart is becoming the queen of the apron bump. And when I say that, it's not really meant to be a complete compliment, because every time I see her do a move like that, I worry that she's going to kill herself. But she has become the queen of either giving or taking the apron bump here on NXT. Candice LeRae, all of a sudden in the middle of the match, she pops up on the Titantron. "Hey, Shotzi, over here." And she said that, "I found your tank. It was out here in the middle of nowhere. It was in the middle of the road. There it is. I'm going to look after it, though. You don't worry about it. I'm going to stay here, and I'm going to look after your tank and make sure that nothing happens to it." And she gets rolled up because she's distracted. So Shotzi gets rolled up by Toni Storm. Toni Storm gets the win. So what could have ended up being a very good match here, this was just meant to be a backdrop to the angle involving Candice. So this was not as good as it could have been. But Candice, match is over. She's on the screen. And she is sarcastically telling Shotzi, "I'm not sure how much longer I could stay out here and protect your tank." All of a sudden, a Hummer. We see a Hummer. And Candice gets into the driver's seat of this giant Hummer. No, it was not the white Hummer that WCW never resolved, that whole storyline. She gets in the Hummer, and she runs the tank over. She actually was dragging it for a while. I was waiting for her to just stop the car, back up, and try again, because it just looked like she was just going to keep dragging it. But eventually, it finally ended up underneath the Hummer, and the tank was destroyed. And she says, "Now we're even." This was after Shotzi got involved in her tables, ladders, and scares match with Io Shirai at Halloween Havoc. We saw Ghostface was sitting in the back of the Hummer. I still say it'll end up being Indy Hartwell and the other Ghostface, who we saw in a separate segment at home with Johnny Gargano, who is celebrating his North American title win. sitting at the kitchen table with Johnny was Ghostface. So there's two different Ghostfaces. I still think one's Austin Theory and the other one is Indy Hartwell. And we end up with a little Gargano faction out of it. Shotzi Blackheart watching her tank get dragged underneath that Hummer. It was like watching Candace run over her dog. Now, I know that her helmet, her Viking helmet, like legit, means a lot to her. Because she lost that recently. Her car got stolen. And she was more upset about the helmet that was in the trunk than she was about the car. She was in tears on social media. I can't believe this happened. I filed a police report, and she probably didn't think she was ever going to see it again. But it has sentimental value to her, because I guess she's been wearing that helmet ever since she got started in the wrestling business, or maybe somebody special gave it to her, I don't know. But the helmet, I know, has sentimental value to her. And eventually the police did recover the car, and she got her helmet back. There has been no backstory given to why Shotzi Blackheart would care this much about a toy tank. So watching her break down like this, I mean, this was like the worst. She was watching a family member get murdered and there was nothing that she could do about it. Watching her break down over a toy tank the way that she was here on TV was embarrassing. I didn't feel sympathy for her. I just felt embarrassed for her. Like, what a wuss. What a wuss. It is a toy tank. It's like a Tonka tank. Go to Toys R Us. Well, I guess there is no Toys R Us anymore. Are there any toy stores left? I feel like they're all gone. Toys R Us is gone. KB Toy and Hobby hasn't been around for years. Those were always the two toy stores when I was a kid. It was Toys R Us or KB. I don't even know if they have toy stores anymore. Probably just like the local mom and pop shops, I guess. Boy, it must suck for kids. Then again, I guess they just get everything off Amazon or BestBuy.com or go to Walmart. I guess they have everything you need. But yes, this was very embarrassing. They had another live installment of the Thatch as Thatch Can with Timothy Thatcher. And he was giving a lesson to someone on reversals. And eventually, Anthony Green, former Evolve star Anthony Green, who was in the first live Thatch as Thatch Can and was abused for a while there by Thatcher. And then they had a match and Thatcher beat him. He showed up again. And so it looks like they're setting up a match. He is no longer Anthony Green, by the way. He has been given a new name. And his new name, I believe, is August Gray. August Gray is the new name for Anthony Green. I can think of worse names. I've heard much, much worse than August Gray. Which just seems like a very odd name, because Anthony Green usually... When I've seen Anthony Green, he's usually wearing, like, bright colors. You've given him the name Gray. I don't know, it just seems kind of strange to me. Main event was Tommaso Ciampa getting a win over the Velveteen Dream. They did the old Bret Hart Dynamite Kid suplex over the top rope out of the ring spot towards the end. And Dream threw a chair into the ring. Didn't actually use it. Instead, he jumped off the top rope. Ciampa caught him with a jumping knee strike on the way down. And followed that with a widow's bell and the fairy tale ending for the win. So Velveteen Dream continues to play the role of punching bag on TV, which is not surprising given all of the allegations against him. It is a huge headache for the company. And it's more than one allegation. So true or not, we may never find out the truth. But when you have that sort of thing hanging over you, it is probably going to make the company less likely to put you in any kind of a meaningful role on TV. He probably should be thankful he's even on TV. But every time we see Velveteen Dream, whether it's Kushida or here it was Tommaso Ciampa, he's doing the JOB. And here's a guy who had such, and still has potential, but he had so much buzz. It was like, all right, when's he being called up? You know, when is he going to be the next guy that Vince McMahon doesn't know what to do with and they ruin him? Or... what's, you know, the Velveteen Dream is a star in the making. And honestly, now I question his future. I question the future that he now has in this company. And as far as how they're using him now, I don't know if this is just a waiting out period, if there's still things going on behind the scenes that we're not aware of or things that are being investigated. I don't know. But it don't look good. And every time I look at this guy now, I can't look at him the same way I looked at him before. There's just too much there for me to look at him and ignore everything that's been talked about until all of this gets settled. I don't think we're going to see him doing much of anything meaningful on this show. We'll see him continue probably to be used exactly the way that he's been used, to put other people over. This is not about getting over the Velveteen Dream. This was about getting over Tommaso Ciampa. Ciampa is very interesting because he was being positioned as a heel again. They were starting to position him as a heel, and they even teased something maybe with him and Kyle O'Reilly once out in the parking lot when I think Kyle interrupted. I think he was attacking Jake Atlas, and Kyle came over to stop him, and that never went anywhere. You know, Ciampa said something like, "I'll be seeing you soon," and then they never followed up on that. Here, he was just a total badass babyface in this match, and I wonder if that has more to do with the injury to Finn Balor and the fear that he may not be able to come back as quickly from that broken jaw as they would like for him to come back. We haven't gotten any kind of medical update in the last couple of weeks on Finn Balor. They were hopeful that he maybe only would be gone for maybe 6 weeks or so, and we're approaching that point. We've got no update, so I wonder if this is just sort of their hedge against that, and if we can't get Balor back, we need somebody in that babyface spot, and that person could be Tommaso Ciampa. Because when this show was over, I mean, the piped-in crowd noise and the people cheering him and just the way they positioned him was definitely not as a heel. In this match, he was definitely not the heel. But I hope Balor does come back soon. I would like to see them, as I said before, build or start building to a Finn Balor, Pete Dunne match, maybe at an early 2021 takeover show. Maybe they could even get there over WrestleMania weekend. Maybe that could be the big championship match Mania weekend in March or April.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, which is fast becoming a favorite for many of you, I've seen the comments in the clips on YouTube. I'm glad you guys are enjoying it. Hope you're enjoying it as much as I am, taking a trip down memory lane. This week, we begin 39 years ago this week on November 4th, 1981. In his weekly column for the Philadelphia Journal, Gorilla Monsoon announced that superstar Billy Graham had died of cancer in his hometown of Paradise Valley, Arizona, which surely came as news to Billy Graham, who was still very much alive, and in fact, remains alive to this very day. Graham lost the WWF title to Bob Backlund in 1978. He had left the company later on that year to wrestle elsewhere. In 1980, he stopped. And in 1981, he wrestled, I think, all of two matches the entire year. So he sort of dropped off the face of the earth a little bit, and as the story goes, Monsoon had heard a rumor that he had passed away, and so he printed that in his column. And when Graham came back in 1982 to wrestling, looking completely different, he was doing a kung fu type gimmick. It was like kung fu Billy Graham. He was looking smaller, you know, still muscular, but smaller than most people remember him being. He ended up not drawing very well in Philadelphia, probably because people thought that he really was dead and that it was an imposter Billy Graham, because we had heard and read in the newspaper that Billy Graham had died, and now this guy comes back claiming to be him, but that don't look like Billy Graham, so this must be an imposter. And the best part is that Monsoon never printed a retraction. It is the very definition of fake news. 32 years ago this week, on November 4th, 1988, John Carpenter's They Live, starring Rowdy Roddy Piper, was released in theaters here in this country. It opened at number one. It grossed nearly $5 million in its first 3 days, which was pretty good for back then. Carpenter was a big wrestling fan. He was very excited to meet Piper for the first time at WrestleMania 3. Piper later on admitted that when he met Carpenter for the first time, he had no idea who he was. He was introduced to him. It was a very cordial meeting. Carpenter knew who he was, but he had no idea who John Carpenter was. And in the film, Piper plays a drifter who discovers a special pair of sunglasses that allows him to distinguish human beings from aliens, who are very quickly taking over the planet, and they're blending in as humans, and they're sending subliminal messages through the media. There's a lot of political overtones to the movie. But the movie features one of the all-time great fight scenes in cinema, and one of the longest. A 5-minute-plus fist fight in an alley between Piper and Keith David, who was awesome in this movie, and he was awesome in The Thing, another Carpenter classic from the 80s. If you've never seen it, watch it. 26 years ago this week, on November 6th, 1994, AAA held its first and only North American pay-per-view show titled When Worlds Collide, which WCW helped co-promote. Mike Tenay had hosted a wrestling radio show at the time, and this was his commentary debut. Every other WCW announcer declined to do the show, which is why Tenay ended up getting the spot. He knew a lot about Lucha Libre, he knew the wrestlers, he knew the holds. This is the show, ultimately, that would earn him a spot later on Monday Nitro. And WCW also began to bring in a lot of luchadors, and they would have Tenay do guest spots on commentary because he actually knew what the hell he was talking about. I love Bobby Heenan to death. I was never really the biggest Bobby Heenan fan of his run in WCW. To me, Bobby Heenan was never the same after he left WWE in 1993, but the one thing I must criticize him for, it was painful sometimes to listen to Bobby Heenan on commentary calling a cruiserweight match in WCW because he just didn't know what he was talking about. That was not, you know, he was not in his comfort zone during those matches. That's why they would bring in Tenay. Tenay would know the backstory between these two guys and he would know the names of all the moves. That really is where his strength was. But the match that this show is most remembered for is the classic tag team match pitting Los Gringos Locos, the team of Eddie Guerrero, and Love Machine Art Barr against Octagon and El Hijo del Santo. It was a best of three falls mask versus hair match where both members of each team had to be eliminated during each fall. They went into the final fall. They were all knotted up, one fall apiece, with the Gringos losing and getting their head shaved. And this would turn out to be Art Barr's final match. He died about 2 weeks later of what is believed to have been a heart attack, but his death is still classified as being due to unknown or unspecified causes. After that match, Paul Heyman wanted to bring him in. He wanted to bring in Art Barr and Eddie Guerrero to ECW. They had interest from all of the major promotions, but Eddie ended up going. Eddie went on to much bigger things. And he even started to use Art Barr's frog splash as a tribute to his late friend. And in case you haven't looked at the calendar, you might know that in the segment next week, I'm going to be talking about Eddie Guerrero, unfortunately, in a very similar way to Art Barr. So that's coming up next week. The next day, on November 7th, 1994, it was an episode of Monday Night Raw. Vince McMahon did something that he rarely, if ever, really. I mean, I can't remember another time where I saw him do something like this on television, on one of his shows. He gave a seemingly heartfelt goodbye on TV to the Macho Man, Randy Savage, somebody who he was negotiating with for a new contract, and they couldn't come to terms. And instead of just kind of ignoring the fact that he wasn't there or even going on TV and burying the guy, he gave a very heartfelt speech, and this is what he said. He said, "Conspicuous by his absence is the Macho Man Randy Savage. I would like to announce that unfortunately, Randy Savage has been unable to sign a new contract with the World Wrestling Federation. Unable to rather come to terms with the World Wrestling Federation for a new contract. Randy, I know you're out there listening, and on behalf of all of us here in the World Wrestling Federation, all of your fans, and certainly from me, your number one fan, I would like to thank you for all of your positive contributions to the World Wrestling Federation. Thank you, Randy Savage, for all of the wonderful memories for so many years in the World Wrestling Federation. We wish you nothing but the best. Godspeed, and good luck." Boy, he sure did like saying World Wrestling Federation, didn't he? He got about 5 or 6 World Wrestling Federation mentions in there in about 45 seconds. Holy shit. But that, you know, Randy Savage's final appearance was the week before. The Halloween episode of Monday Night Raw, he was on commentary as he was every week with Vince McMahon, and then he was gone. That will go down forever as his final WWE televised appearance. He had been working without a contract for some time. And what Vince McMahon thought was a verbal agreement with him, he thought he had what was a verbal agreement with Savage to stay. Well, apparently those discussions for a new contract broke down. And Savage wanted to wrestle. This is really what it boiled down to. And I think his brother, the genius, you know, Lanny Poffo, I think has talked about this as well. Savage was not ready to give, you know, kind of give up his career. He was not ready to hang up the tights. He still felt that he had gas left in the tank and that he could still contribute in the ring. He wanted to wrestle. He is a wrestler. Vince McMahon, though, was trying to move beyond that and start focusing on what they started dubbing the new generation. 1994 was the start of the new generation. Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker and Yokozuna and all these, you know, Tatanka and all these different people. And Randy just was not part of those plans. And now you'll hear Jerry the King Lawler. And he did this actually on the Broken Skull Sessions with Stone Cold on the network. Very good interview, but it drove me nuts listening to him talk about this. And it may just be that he really is, he's just misremembering. He's not lying or making it up. Maybe his memory is just faulty when it comes to this, but he tells this erroneous story about being backstage that night at Monday Night Raw and being shocked when they put Nitro on one of the TVs backstage. And what did they see? They saw the Macho Man Randy Savage on screen. Forgetting that WCW Monday Nitro did not even exist in 1994. Savage did not debut on WCW television. It was on Saturday night, actually. He didn't debut on WCW television for another month after McMahon even gave this speech. McMahon knew full well that he was negotiating a deal with WCW. He came to find out that he was negotiating a deal with WCW to the point that WCW was served with papers a few days before Savage showed up live on TV. Because if I remember, I think that WCW Saturday night appearance when he debuted, I think that was a live episode. So what happened is WWE served legal papers a few days before that to WCW, claiming that if they put him on TV, it would constitute a breach of contract. The only thing is, there was no contract. And evidently, the lawyers felt that, you know, they huddled together with WCW management, who wanted to know, look, is it safe for us to put this guy on TV? And the lawyers got together with them and said, look, you know, there is no breach of contract here. There is no jeopardy in putting Randy Savage on our television show. And that's exactly what happened. And there was no lawsuit. There was no fallout from that. It was just an intimidation move by WWE. But it had no teeth. They had no grounds. There was no contract. Now, I don't doubt that Vince McMahon felt betrayed by somebody who he considered a friend. And that he took the Slim Jim. This cannot be, I think, downplayed enough. Savage, when he left, he also took with him the Slim Jim sponsorship. Eric Bischoff has said that that Slim Jim sponsorship that Savage brought with him when he walked in the door at WCW was worth $1 million a year in revenue to WCW. It also had to be very embarrassing for WWE because Savage was the feature star on the cover of the December 94 issue of WWF magazine. The very same month he debuted for WCW, he's on the cover of the WWF magazine. You talk about bad timing. I still have that issue, actually, in my bookshelf here somewhere with the rest of my old magazines. I started buying the WWF magazine. I had a subscription. And the very first issue I ever got was February of 1992. Was that issue where Ric Flair is in like this director's chair? He was on the cover of the magazine. I got Flair to sign that magazine actually many years ago. So I know I have the Savage issue. It's in there. So I still have all the magazines. I have it in here somewhere. But anyway, Savage himself in interviews has said that and he didn't do too many interviews, but you can, if you go on YouTube, you will find a couple of shoot style interviews with Randy Savage from around like 1999, 2000, somewhere around there. He didn't do very many of them, though. But he did say that the reason he left was simply because Vince McMahon had a different view of what he should be doing, and Randy wanted to wrestle. All the rumors years later about why he was blacklisted from the company, it's just that. It's just rumors. And it could just be as simple as Vince McMahon feeling betrayed in a way that he never did with any of the other people who left him. 24 years ago this week, on the November 4th, 1996 episode of Monday Night Raw, on the very same show where some pineapple head looking kid named Rocky Maivia, remember that haircut, made his very first appearance, his actual first on-screen appearance on TV. On that same night, one of the most controversial angles in WWE history took place when Stone Cold Steve Austin traveled to the home of Brian Pillman in Cincinnati, Ohio. Austin had put Pillman back on the shelf when he Pillmanized his ankle. That's where the whole Pillmanized term comes from. He Pillmanized his ankle, put the chair over the ankle and stomped on it and re-broke it. In real life, Pillman needed more surgery on his ankle. His ankle was all just completely jacked up from the Hummer accident that he was in a few months earlier. So he needed more surgery. That was their way of getting him off of TV. So they did a big angle where Austin was the one to put him back on the shelf. And so Austin was on his way to Pillman's home. But Pillman was prepared. Pillman was prepared with his wife standing right behind him. Pillman was on the couch and his leg was all wrapped up on the couch. And he brandished a 9mm. And he said, when Austin 316 meets Pillman 9mm, I'm going to blow his ass straight to hell. And when Austin arrived, he ran into some of Pillman's friends outside the house, who he promptly beat up. Some friends they turned out to be. He broke into the house. There was a window in the back door. He smashed in the window. He unlocked the door. They filmed this whole thing. And Austin comes into the house, and the last shot that we see is of Pillman, and he's on his feet, hobbling on one leg, holding up the weapon right in front of his face, about to fire, and the feed cuts. And when they cut back to the arena, so I believe this angle was shot live, and the matches were all pre-taped, because Raw was not live that week, so they cut back to the pre-taped matches in the building. And Vince McMahon and Jerry Lawler and Jim Ross are on commentary, and they're talking about this like it's such a tragedy. They have that different tone in their voice. They can't believe what just happened. They're trying to get more information. Oh my God, what just happened here? We don't know exactly what happened. Eventually, they cut back to the house. Everybody was still alive. Austin had left, but then he came back. I remember Kevin Kelly going, oh my God, he's back again. And chaos just ensued all over again. Curse words were flying, unedited, on the USA Network because, like I said, the segment aired live. Unlike all the other ones that night, USA Network was not happy. USA Network did know about the angle in advance. They did approve it. What they did not approve of, though, and what WWE apparently did not know about, or they claimed they didn't know about, was all of the foul language that was going to be making the air live. And this was something that Austin and Pillman, I guess, my understanding is, they just kind of decided to do that on their own to heat things up a little bit with the language because they wanted to try to make this angle more realistic. And that was their way of doing it. And let me tell you, they succeeded. The problem is that this just so happened to be the first week in Raw's new time slot, which was an hour earlier. Nitro had creamed them for like 18 straight weeks at that point in the ratings. And so USA Network, they bumped Raw up by an hour. So now you're airing even earlier in the night. And then the very first week that your show is airing earlier in the night, you have this happen. So you can understand why they would be upset. WWE was in full apology mode that weekend on Livewire. with Vince McMahon. Vince McMahon was on Livewire, which was their live call-in show on USA Network on Saturday mornings, which I would like to see them add that to the network soon. I hope they do. Always fun to go back and watch the episode where Bruce from Connecticut called in, which was Paul Heyman under an assumed name. But Vince McMahon was on Livewire that weekend, and he apologized. And he took full responsibility for what happened in the segment, even though Pillman called in. I mean, you could tell they were in full apology mode because they had Brian Pillman call in. Pillman was trying to apologize for his behavior, and Vince McMahon said, "No, no, it's my fault." Excuse me, he goes, "It's my fault. I'm the one who's responsible for what people see on the television show, so it's not your fault." You know, I remember watching it live and thinking that it was the most exciting thing that I had seen on WWE television in a very long time. So with this fan, this segment worked. This segment got a lot of people talking. A lot of my friends. This is just a small sample size here, but it got a lot of people talking. When I say that the Attitude Era, you've heard me say that the Attitude Era didn't start in 98 or even late 97. I've traced the beginnings and I've credited the beginning of the Attitude Era to 1996. That is where the Attitude Era began to take shape. The Attitude Era began, as far as I'm concerned, in the fall of 1996. That is when the Attitude Era started. And this is maybe the angle that you can cite that really kicked things off. But I've always said the end of the year in 96 when Brett came back and you had those top four or five guys, all of whom were feuding over the championship. You had Sid, you had Bret Hart, you had Shawn Michaels, and you can throw in Vader and, you know, The Undertaker in there as well, Austin. So it was actually a group of like five or six guys. Everybody was always walking around pissed off. It wasn't for jokes, it wasn't for comedy, it wasn't for anything like that. Everybody wanted the championship, everybody hated each other, everybody had some kind of beef with the other guy, babyfaces didn't like the other, Bret Hart didn't like Shawn didn't like Bret, we know that. But Austin was walking around every week all pissed off, and, you know, that to me is where I trace back the roots of the Attitude Era. And then what really set things off was a few months later, before WrestleMania 13, when Brett lost on Raw in that cage match, and he flipped out. He shoved Vince McMahon on his keister, and he started cursing on television. This is bullshit. You know, if you people don't like it, tough shit. So you want to trace back the roots of the Attitude Era, you go back to that. 22 years ago this week, on November 2nd, 1998, Vince McMahon, from his motorized wheelchair, unveiled the Hardcore Championship for the very first time, and he awarded the title to Mankind as a way to curry favor with him and keep him away from The Rock, who Mick Foley was very friendly with on TV. He gifted him the title, contingent on him not getting involved in the match that night between The Rock and Ken Shamrock. It would be the one and only time that Mankind would hold the Hardcore title. He lost it a few weeks later, maybe a month later, to the Big Boss Man. On that same Monday Night Raw episode, Vince McMahon also gave us this very memorable quote. For those people who are wondering when or even if Vince McMahon may ever give up control of the company to his kids or anyone else, I think this is a very telling quote. Austin, Stone Cold Steve Austin, was in the ring and Vince is on the stage in his wheelchair and he says, "Austin, you'd like it if I retired, wouldn't you? You'd really like that. You'd like it if I retired. And Shane, you'd really like it if I stepped down so that you could take over, right?" And then he looks at the fans and he says, "And all of you, you would all like it if Vince McMahon sort of faded away, sort of disappeared. Some of you would even like it if I died." And people cheered. He goes, "Well, let me say this. That's the only way that I am ever going to step down as the chairman of this organization is the day I die. And when I die, I don't want a damned one of you to come to my funeral. No family, no friends, no superstars. When I die, I want to go straight to hell." Vince McMahon, he was like peak Mr. McMahon during that period. 98 into 99. Although, to be fair, he was still pretty good even into 2000. But that Mr. McMahon character at his peak was just the best. But there's a lot of truth. Here we are over 20 years later, and there is a lot of truth in that quote. I think that's about the only way that you're going to see Vince McMahon not as the chairman of the board of this company. 16 years ago this week, on November 2nd, 2004, at the SmackDown taping in St. Louis, Missouri, Kurt Angle challenged all of the contestants in the Million Dollar Tough Enough Challenge. This was season 4 of Tough Enough, which was done a little bit differently. It used to be its own standalone show on MTV for the first, I guess, 2 or 3 seasons. And here, what they did for this season was they just hosted a whole series of segments that would just air on SmackDown every week. And that was a counter to the Diva Search, which was being held on Monday Night Raw. So Raw had the Diva Search, and SmackDown had the Million Dollar Tough Enough Challenge. Daniel Pewter was one of the contestants that season on Tough Enough. And Pewter had a background in mixed martial arts. He had fought at least once, maybe twice before then. So he had some MMA experience coming into this thing. He volunteered to wrestle Kurt Angle in an amateur competition to get in the ring and just kind of spar with him a little bit. And so he gets into the ring, and this is the incident that still gets talked about to this very day. They started wrestling. Pewter gets Kurt's arm locked in a key lock, which is like a Kimura lock. See, I don't know if there's a difference between a key lock and a Kimura lock. Maybe somebody who's more MMA-oriented can comment and let me know what is the difference between a key lock and a Kimura lock. Because to me, it just seems like the name might be interchangeable. They look like the same move. So we'll call it a key lock. He gets him in this thing. It looks like he's going to break Kurt's arm. He's got Kurt's arm behind him. He's wrenching back on the arm. And this could have been a complete and total disaster. I mean, this was on its way to being that. This was on its way to turning into a disaster. This would have made Kurt look very, very bad. Thanks to some quick thinking, though, from referee Jimmy Corderas, who could tell that this was on the verge of ending very badly for Kurt Angle. When Kurt fell forward on top of Pewter, he still had his arm wrenched behind him, but he fell kind of on top of Pewter. And that is when Corderas, he saw his opportunity, and he dropped down, and he made a quick 3 count. Even though Pewter's shoulder came up at 2, he counted 3 anyway. Corderas knew that he had to put an end to this. He did not have anybody in his ear. He did not have Vince McMahon or anybody in his ear telling him to do that. He just instinctively started counting. Had he not done so, Kurt Angle would have had to tap out to this rookie, or he possibly would have gotten his arm broken. Although I would think if Pewter wanted a contract with this company, he would have known better than to actually follow through and break the guy's arm. But I'll tell you what, if he did, I mean, this incident still gets talked about, but this guy would have been a hero forever. You challenge Kurt Angle, Kurt's like, all right, kid, get your ass in the ring. And you go in there and you break the arm of this Olympic gold medalist. I mean, he would have had a wrestling gimmick. His gimmick would have been solidified for the rest of his life. He could have made money on the independent scene just going around and saying, hey, I'm the guy who broke Kurt Angle's arm on SmackDown. He could have made a killing. So that could have ended very, very badly. And it's not that Kurt couldn't handle himself. Like, he's not a tough guy. Of course, Kurt Angle is a tough guy, but he was physically very beat up. And no matter how tough you may be, there are certain holds and submissions that if you get trapped, there's no way out. You have a guy here in Pewter who is younger. I don't know if he was stronger at that point, but yeah, I don't care how tough Kurt Angle is. Everybody can get caught. Every great fighter, right? You get punched in the face. All it takes is one good shot. Everybody can get caught on any given day. And that almost happened to Kurt Angle here in this segment. Now, Al Snow was the head trainer on Tough Enough. He became like a father figure on those early seasons of Tough Enough for a lot of these guys. And Al Snow has talked about this in shoot interviews, and he has said, he goes, this is why you do not do things like this in the wrestling business. This is why you try, if you can, to work everything, if at all possible, to not allow for outcomes that you cannot control. And according to Snow, who was in the ring and watched the whole thing right in front of his eyes go down, he was in the ring during this whole segment. He told the people in the back, he's never said who, if it was Vince or somebody else, but he told the people in the back, this is a bad idea. And they wanted to do it anyway. They insisted on doing it anyway, just like they did something very similar with Big Show. There was another Tough Enough segment on SmackDown that same season, and there was an incident with Big Show. And they wanted Big Show to body slam each one of the Tough Enough guys. And Al Snow said that he recommended against that. He said, why don't we do this? Let's have Big Show chop them across the chest instead. Because if he body slams them, they don't know how to sell it. You might have one or two guys. Maybe they've wrestled independently and they can sell okay. But a lot of these guys are very inexperienced. They're not trained professional wrestlers. They are not going to know how to properly sell a body slam from a guy who, when he body slams you, you better sell the shit out of it, because this is the biggest guy, physically, the biggest guy that we have on our roster. This is a bad idea. And again, they insisted. If you go back and you watch that segment, Big Show was visibly angry with a lot of those guys because a couple of them deadweighted him. You could see they deadweighted him on the lift. Why would you do that? Why would you deadlift the Big Show? Why would you try to piss off the Big Show? I mean, do you actually think that's going to get you in the good graces of the people backstage in that company? You're trying to get a contract for a job to work there. You really want to make your life a living hell, but it's just, they're just young and dumb and they're inexperienced. And they're like, oh, I'm better than all these guys. And they're too stupid to realize. They're too ignorant and too stupid to realize that what they're doing is they're shooting themselves in the foot. And Big Show was pissed. Ryback sold it. Ryback was on that season. The Miz was on that season. The Miz sold it. But if you go back and watch, Big Show was angry because these other idiots in the segment who were deadweighting him and who weren't selling the body slam. Now, he still slammed them because he's a 450-pound giant and he's going to slam you whether or not you want to go up for it or not. But with one guy, as soon as he slammed him, he immediately dropped a very stiff elbow onto his chest. That guy didn't get up so fast after that. There was another one after he slammed him. It might have been that Daniel Rotimer guy who I think he just ran for a congressional seat. I think he lost in the election. He just ran for some state office and I think he lost. But I think it was Rotimer. He picked up Rotimer and slammed him. He also tried to deadweight him, and as soon as Big Show slammed him, he dropped a knee right down onto his chest. That guy didn't get up so fast either. This is why you don't put your wrestlers in a position to be made to look bad. Steve-O found that out the hard way years later on Raw with Umaga. 13 years ago this week, on November 6th, 2007, yours truly recorded the very first episode of the Solomonster Sounds Off podcast, which found a home at the time on sescoops.com. This week is the big anniversary. It ran a whopping, that first episode ran a whopping 7.5 minutes, which is still the shortest episode that I have ever done. Here we are, 677 episodes later. And that doesn't even include all of the YouTube stuff. That doesn't include all of the reviews and the streams on YouTube. But this was a rare Tuesday episode of the Sound Off. I talked about Monday Night Raw from the night before, which saw the supposed one-night-only reunion of DX with Shawn Michaels and Triple H, which is comical when you consider how many DX reunions we've had since then. Before then and since then. And the return of Stone Cold Steve Austin to confront Santino Marella, who had been talking a lot of crap about him for weeks on TV. Austin was there to promote his new movie, The Condemned, which was coming out on DVD. And then he gave Santino a beer bath. Not quite the same as the beer bath he gave the corporation. But sequels are rarely as good as the original. And 2 years ago, on November 2nd, 2018. WWE held its crown jewel show from Riyadh. Sweet Saudi Money 2, Electric Boogaloo. Featuring Kurt Angle's first singles match in a WWE ring in 12 years. A first round loss to Dolph Ziggler in the World Cup tournament, which Shane McMahon went on to win. He went on to become the best in the world. Brock Lesnar beat Braun Strowman to become the new Universal Champion after Roman Reigns was forced to vacate the title due to his leukemia diagnosis. And Shawn Michaels returned to the ring for the first time in 8 years for a disastrous tag team match pitting DX against the Brothers of Destruction. A match where bald Shawn Michaels, which is still just, it looks wrong and it sounds wrong, but there he was. Bald Shawn Michaels looked the best out of all of these men in the ring. And he's the one that retired coming into the match. He's the one who hadn't had a match in 8 years. And he looked better than everybody else. Kane's mask and wig accidentally got went flying off his head. He was on the top rope with Shawn Michaels and Shawn punched him. And yeah, the wig is attached to the mask and it goes flying and Kane is trying to cover up as if we don't know what the fucking guy looks like. He's trying to cover up. He had a scurry down outside the ring to quickly put the mask back on. Triple H, not 5 minutes into this match, tore his pec. And he was basically working the match with one arm. I respect the effort, but this was just sad to watch. Four men that I grew up watching, these guys were such a big part of my... I mean, I wasn't really even as... You know, they were in the middle of probably their prime run during the Attitude Era. I mean, I wasn't a young child anymore, but I consider that my childhood still. These four guys were such a big part of my wrestling childhood, and I watched them for so many years, and I saw them in their prime, and, you know, to watch them in the ring in this kind of match where everything just felt like it was falling apart, and how slow some of them were moving, which is understandable because they're a lot older and they're a lot more beat up, especially Undertaker. I mean, you can understand it, but here I'm watching these four guys no longer in the primes of their careers, just doing it, you know, as Shawn Michaels said, because they thought it would be fun to do. And it looked like they were having anything but fun. It didn't look like it was very fun even for them. But I'm sure they got a very nice payday out of it. They were soaking their tears in their dollar bills. And that is why, you know, they have a lot of big names on these shows. Why do you think they've gotten Brock Lesnar to constantly go back to Saudi Arabia, or The Undertaker to constantly go back to Saudi Arabia? Because they're making ridiculous money for a few minutes of work. So it's not hard to understand why they do it. Pay me that much money to fly halfway across the world to wrestle for 10 minutes. I'm going to have to think about that. I can't give you an answer right now, but more than likely, I'll be on that plane. And I hope that these guys, all four of them really, but, you know, Michaels, I just try to pretend this match didn't happen and that he had a nice send-off at WrestleMania 26. That is how I choose to remember the final match of Shawn Michaels. Let's take some of your questions, a little preview before the big Inbox Anniversary stream on YouTube this Thursday night. You can email your questions to me, thesolemonster @gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from so I can credit you when and if I use your question. We'll start with Adam from Brooklyn. Since Jon Moxley will more than likely beat Eddie Kingston at Full Gear, which he obviously did, do you think that he will make it to the 1 year mark as champion or drop it to somebody before then? My guess is that he'll lose it to Kenny Omega before the year ends. I think that they can get to Revolution before they do the title change. It is very possible they don't want to wait until then, and maybe Omega will beat him before then. I think he makes it. I think he makes it to the 1 year mark and he drops it to Omega in February. That's what I think. Ant from Manchester, UK. In the short history of both titles, buy or sell, based on title matches and the legacy that they have created, the AEW World Championship or the NXT UK Championship? I mean, based on the matches, I got to buy on the NXT UK title. I got to buy on that one and sell on the AEW championship. There are three matches that stand out in my mind that in any year, if they aren't match of the year, they're in contention for match of the year, top two or three. And these are not just matches. These are battles. These are wars. These guys are fighting for everything they have to try to win this championship. And they have resulted in some of the best matches that I've seen in the last 3 or 4 years. And it really goes back, the first truly great one that I remember, and this is back when it was still the WWE UK title, and before they rebranded it as the NXT UK Championship, but it has the same, you know, title history, is the match between Pete Dunne and Tyler Bate at TakeOver Chicago in 2017. One of my favorite matches, if not, I think it might have been, I have to go back and see what I called my match of the year in 2017. It might have been that match. I love that match. That match was fantastic. So I think of that. I think of Walter last year against Tyler Bate, TakeOver Cardiff. An unbelievable war. And then the match that I just saw a few weeks ago with Walter and Ilya Dragunov from NXT UK. And that was in an empty building. That was inside of a studio. That wasn't even in front of a live, raucous, you know, UK crowd. And it may end up going down as the match of the year anywhere in wrestling. So when you've put together a resume like that, and I think of the AEW title, and there have been some good and very good AEW title matches, but none to me that stand out the way that those three matches do, I've got to buy on the NXT UK title. The Saudi Prince, Abdul Aziz. Hope he's doing well, all the way from Saudi Arabia. What was the reason for the heat between Bill Dundee and The Undertaker? In a Shoot interview, Dundee said he doesn't know, but Dutch Mantel might. I'm assuming because Dutch and Undertaker were riding together at the time. Can you please shed some more light on this? Well, I know about as much as you do. Bill Dundee thinks that The Undertaker is the reason that he never got a run in WWE. He basically blames The Undertaker for him not even being able to get a foot in the door with Vince McMahon. And he has no idea why that is. He has no idea. He says if there's heat, the heat is completely from one side. He goes, I have no issues with Mark Calloway. If there's heat there, it is entirely from the Undertaker's side. He says, I never did anything that I know of to have heat with him. This is back when Undertaker was in his mean Mark Callis days. He goes, he always tried to help him when he was in the USWA. He can't understand why Undertaker would have heat with him. Dundee, I think Bill Dundee now is in his 70s. 60s or 70s, but I'm almost positive he's in his 70s. So he would have been late 40s, early 50s, if the time period he mentions, if that's accurate. I don't know why WWE would even have an interest in him at that point. Why would they have an interest in him? I mean, he was never that big of a star. I mean, in certain territories he might have been, but I mean, Bill Dundee is not like some big-time star. And if he was already 50-ish at that point, then why the hell would Vince McMahon want to bring him into the company? It doesn't make any sense. It is entirely possible that he thinks The Undertaker has heat with him, but actually Undertaker has no heat with him. And Vince McMahon just never had any interest in bringing in Bill Dundee. I think that's very possible too. I mean, I know Undertaker has no love lost for Buzz Sawyer because Sawyer kind of screwed him over on the money he paid him to help train him. And he's talked about that. Undertaker actually has talked about the history with Buzz Sawyer. I don't think anybody has ever asked him about Bill Dundee. And I'm not sure why they would. Most people don't even know who the hell Bill Dundee is. People listening to this right now who probably have no idea. This is the first time they're even hearing the name Bill Dundee. They're like, Bill Dundee? I know Crocodile Dundee. I don't know Bill Dundee. But look, Undertaker is going to be back on the Broken Skull Sessions in a few weeks with Steve Austin. I mean, I guess that was taped probably months ago. Maybe there's an off chance that Stone Cold asked him about Bill Dundee. You know, Steve Austin was working the USWA territory around that same time. So, I would not hold my breath on that question coming up, though, in part two of the interview with Austin and The Undertaker. And Jordan wants to know, who would have won a fight between Ole Anderson and Bill Watts? Given how both of these men are notorious assholes and were willing to physically engage with anybody they had a crossword with, I've often wondered who would win in a fight in their primes between Ole Anderson and Cowboy Bill Watts. I think I give the edge to Ole. What say you? I'm sure that Ole was a tough guy, but Bill Watts is also, I think, notoriously a tough guy. Bill Watts is also physically bigger, I think, than Ole was. So that gives him the edge. I'd probably just go with Cowboy Bill Watts. I mean, it's impossible to know. I've never seen either one of them in a real fist fight before, so I don't know. I would go with Bill Watts just because I've heard stories about how tough he could be, and he was a physically bigger guy. And so I will go with Bill Watts. Ole is always a riot to go back and watch some of his shoot interview. He's just the most miserable fucking guy on the planet. But in a charming way. I have been very entertained watching the Ole Anderson shoot. Of course, there's the famous Ole Anderson story. I believe, if I'm getting it right, he was with Vince McMahon, and I think Vince McMahon was trying to introduce Linda, his wife, to Ole. And I think Ole's response was something to the effect of, fuck you and fuck your wife or something. Ole just doesn't like people. That was always the impression I got. He had a good mind for the wrestling business, and there are people who will credit him as being very creative, and he was very successful at times. But just every story I hear about other people who knew Ole or worked with him, and then I hear the man himself in these interviews, and my God. Although I will say I did get a lot of enjoyment out of the RF video shoot interview he did many years ago, where he was just raking Rob Feinstein over the coals. I don't even remember what they were talking about, but he was trying to make some kind of point. And he was talking to Rob like he was just the dumbest person on the face of the earth. And it was probably well-deserved, too. I got some pleasure out of that. But yeah, Ole is just, what a miserable human being. But he was successful, and so when you have people who make money and who are successful in the wrestling business, no matter how miserable they may be, they're always going to find work. They're always going to find work. Keep sending in your questions, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I will be live on YouTube Wednesday night for the Dynamite recap. I hope you guys will join me. Been quiet the last few weeks. We've had a little less traffic, I think, with everything going on, frankly, whether it's all the playoff baseball games and then the election coverage. And now hopefully all of that is behind us and we'll kind of get back to business here with full gear being in the rearview mirror. But I'm going to be with you again Thursday night, live on YouTube. Follow me on Twitter. I'll let you guys know the time. It's probably going to be 8 p.m. Eastern. I might bump that to 9. 8 o'clock might be better just because it probably would be a little bit easier, I would imagine, for the people who are 5 or 6 hours ahead over in the UK. A little bit earlier, so maybe we'll do 8 o'clock. But Thursday night, November 12th, I'm going to be live for the big Sound Off Inbox Anniversary Edition, taking questions, email questions, super chat questions, break out some of the bubbly. We'll have a good time. Until then, be well, stay safe. Next Sunday will be episode 678 of The Sound Off. We are on the march to 700. The 700 Club. It's coming up soon. Probably what, the spring? Spring or summer of 2021 is when we'll hit 700. I'm already looking forward to it. And don't forget, 13-year anniversary t-shirt is still up on ProWrestlingTees.com/SolemonsterSoundsOff. Had a lot of people pick up that anniversary shirt and tweet me photos or email me photos, which I very much love seeing. So keep doing that, and I will see you guys on the streams coming up this week. Until then, take care, guys. Have a great week.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Lars Sullivan, the freak. The announcers referred to Lars as the freak 22 times in one 7-minute segment. They beat you over the head with every little thing until you are so sick to death of hearing it that you just want to rip your ears off.
The Solo Monster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solo Monster on Twitter at Solo Monster.
Solo Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solo Monster Sounds Off.